As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10, place your first bet on any game, and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY-467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.
Hello and welcome to The View from the Lane, our Tottenham Hotspur podcast from The Athletic. My name is Jack Pitbrook and I'm joined as always by Charlie Eccleshare and James Moore. Right now, you can subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 per week. You can read all of our articles on Spurs and so much more, including Charlie's recent brilliant article on Spurs' Champions League run in 2010. Go to theathletic.com/SpursPod and sign up for just £1 per week. That's theathletic.com/SpursPod. It's been a mixed week for Spurs, lost 1-0 at Antwerp and then won 2-1 against Brighton on Sunday evening. And Charlie, you got to see something that we've been waiting 7 years for, which is a Gareth Bale winner.
Yeah, not in quite the circumstances we anticipated, I guess. If years ago we were thinking, what would it be like for Bale to come back? You know, obviously no one in the crowd, but you know, a few claps from the director's box. And a special moment, but obviously, you know, not anything like what it should have been. But it was a really, really well-taken goal and a really important one as well at that time. I mean, Spurs had, you know, had gone back to 1-1 and straight after equalising Brighton, like they had the momentum. Spurs had changed that. I think they looked the more likely to win by the time Bale did score. But even so, you know, just you wouldn't have wanted to kind of be relying on a late winner. And it's the first time Spurs scored in the second half in a home league game this season. So good to get that monkey off their back. Lovely taking goal and a big moment for him and for the club.
Your Twitter coverage is actually essential in a game like this, wasn't it? When hardly anyone was watching on pay-per-view.
That's true, actually. Yeah. Or they would have been watching on a stream that was about 3 minutes behind. So I probably annoyed quite a lot of people who were like, "What? What do you mean Bale scored?" And then
you could have gone into the chat box on the room and told people there was a goal coming.
Yeah, it would have been quite a change of pace from what's normally in those chat boxes. But I could have done.
James, how was the pay-per-view experience?
Yeah, it was fine. I mean, I think if they hadn't won the game, it would feel like £15 frittered away, I guess. But we shouldn't say it was a classic or massively entertaining. But, you know, I think to see Gareth Bale get that winner, I can't think that he scored too many headers first time round. Off the top of my head, I mean, there must have been.
I can't think of any.
There were a few.
There was that one, wasn't there one against, in the Stoke game where he scored that amazing volley? Didn't he also score one where it went in off his face? Does that count?
That was booted at him, yeah.
As a header though? That's his head, isn't it? I mean, that still counts.
Maybe.
And Charlie, how much did you get a sense that, a bit like the Burnley game really, it was an impressive like winning of the 3 points, even if it wasn't like the complete 90-minute performance that we've seen from Spurs earlier in the season?
Yeah, I was thinking about that. It kind of depends which way you want to look at it. I mean, I think they were slightly different in the sense that Burnley away is an accepted difficult place to go and is the kind of fixture I think most fans beforehand just would have taken any sort of win beforehand. Maybe Brighton, the expectation had been that they would be a bit more fluent. It's now two league games where they haven't really been that fluent, which I think would be a concern if they hadn't already shown on multiple occasions this season that they can score tons of goals and look really dangerous. So you hope that you know, it's just winning when you have to. I mean, that's always a thing, isn't it? It's like when you win ugly, you know, is that the sign of a good team, or is that kind of unsustainable? Because against better teams, especially, and given the run of games they have coming up, they're going to have to play better. But yeah, I mean, it was just one of those where maybe as well they were a little bit leggy from Thursday night. I know they heavily rotated, but still, you know, everyone in the squad travelled, and because of all the substitutions, a lot of first team players did play anyway. I mean, I was thinking, just looking at, you know, looking at the games they've had so far, and you'd probably, I don't know what you would have said was par for points beforehand. You probably would have expected them to win all their home games.
Yeah, I reckon been... it's 14 points. I was going to mention this last week, actually.
Do you think?
I think it was 11 points. I think so. I mean, I had this written down last week and it didn't really come up in conversation, but you'd say 12 points at home, I think, from those four games. I mean, it's not, you know, Everton have probably been slightly, well, over the course of the seven games, have probably been slightly better than maybe we would have anticipated. But I still think you'd say Spurs should beat Everton. The others kind of speak for themselves at home, don't they? And then I think if you're being sort of honest and not factoring in how bad Manchester United have been in sort of half of their games this season, you'd probably say they would lose at Old Trafford, because they quite often do. Maybe draw at Southampton and Burnley. And that's it, isn't it? So there you go, 14 points.
Or I guess you might say you might draw at home to Everton, but you'd hope to win one of those Burnley or Southampton games. But yeah, I mean, I was thinking about either, you know, around 14, 16, depending on how optimistic or pessimistic you would be.
I also have the feeling that they have made up for some of those lost points in the Newcastle and West Ham games now, in the sense that they've won two games where they didn't really play fantastically either time. I know Burnley should have been harder than Brighton. You would expect that. But even though, you know, if they hadn't screwed up in those games, they would now be top. Or if they'd won one of those two games where they threw points away, they'd be top. I still feel like there's probably got maybe slightly fewer regrets now. Like, the table does look pretty good. Second place, 2 points behind Liverpool, top scorers in the league, best goal difference in the league. You know, things are shaping up pretty well, I think, for Tottenham, Charlie.
Yeah, I think that's a really good point, especially as, like, Burnley, as we spoke about, it was pretty small margins. And if Tarkowski's header had gone in just before Spurs took the lead, there's every chance Burnley would have just dug in and stuck everyone behind the ball and held on to that 1-0. Also, you think yesterday, Brighton, you know, they were a bit unfortunate. At 1-1, Solly March, who was playing really well, got injured. And I tweeted at the time being like, you know, that could be a bit of a momentum checker for them. So yeah, I think, you know, you've had a couple of games, Newcastle and West Ham, where you're thinking, how did you not win those? And then a couple where, yeah, maybe they could have gone either way. I think the table's, you know, probably around fair. And yeah, it's a good position to be in, 2 points off top. I guess it is just, as we keep saying, that run of games that's coming up is now even a bit, you know, a bit of a cloud on the horizon. But there's nothing to say Spurs, you know, shouldn't be viewing it as an opportunity to take points off their rivals as well, if they go back to playing with the sort of fluency they showed in hammering United, which at the time we would have put down as being this is a tricky one where they may well drop points.
In terms of continuities between the Brighton game and some of the other games, James, did you think that did you get the impression that yesterday it was like one of those games where Spurs should have done what they did against West Ham, for example, and scored lots of goals in the first half, but because they didn't really do that, they let the game drift a little bit in the way they did, for example, against Newcastle?
Yeah, maybe. I mean, I think a few people have noticed this, that it kind of feels a bit like what happened at the end of that West Ham game has stung Mourinho and possibly the players a bit. And clearly they've been far more conservative in the three matches since, and they haven't looked anywhere near as fluid or as dynamic going forward. I mean, Son was especially quiet yesterday. I mean, I can't really think there were too many moments at all from him, really, in the hour or so that he played. I mean, there wasn't really much to say of his performance at all. So yeah, you can kind of see the logic there. I mean, they really chucked that one away, and without wanting to kind of dwell on it again, to concede three goals in the last 8 minutes of a game when you're 3-0 up at home is abysmal, really, on a sort of mental and technical level. So I can kind of see why a reaction to that might be to kind of go back to basics, for want of a better phrase, which is kind of what they've done. I mean, I don't think that's been entirely voluntary that they've done that, particularly in the game on Sunday, where I actually thought, you know, I suppose in a game where Brighton had a lot of the ball and looked pretty good, I don't think they quite had the punch up front with the players they had missing. But, you know, they look dangerous. I mean, without wanting to kind of make excuses, Brighton are obviously a half-decent team. And, you know, we've seen the game they had against Manchester United at home in the Premier League, whatever you think of Manchester United, and we don't want to go into that again, Jack. You know, they absolutely battered Man United. I mean, they really could. I mean, I know Manchester United won that game in the, you know, it after the game had actually finished, ludicrously. But I think, you know, Brighton could have had like six or seven in that game, like Spurs did the next week. So, you know, they're clearly no chumps. And I don't think there are many dreadful teams in the Premier League. And you're right to mention that I think Spurs have only played one team or two maybe that finished in the top half last season so far. Although I would say Southampton finished in the bottom half, I think, and they would definitely finish in the top half this time around. Yeah, I know there are bigger tests to come, but to coin a phrase, you can only beat what's in front of you.
It's interesting, just James, you make that point about the after the 3-3 kind of tightening up. It made me think of when in Mourinho's second spell at Chelsea, Chelsea lost 3-2 away at Stoke in a kind of madcap game in December of 2013. And then after that, it was kind of like, right, we're not doing this anymore. We're going to tighten up. I wonder if something similar has happened. I don't think so. I don't think it's as stark because that 3-0 West Ham game felt more of an aberration, even if there were, as I said and wrote at the time, you know, warning signs. But it will be interesting to see kind of if it was more kind of, right, we need to just bank a couple of wins, try and keep it tight. And they've conceded one in those two league games before returning to a, you know, a more enterprising way of playing, or whether that is, you know, we will be seeing more of the kind of cautious approach for the rest of the season.
And I think I'm right in saying, due to the way the games are staggered next weekend, that if they win against West Brom on Sunday lunchtime, they'll go top of the league for at least 2 hours, maybe four, maybe like 2 weeks, depending on what else happens in the international break and whatever.
Well, I mean, yeah, there's a chance they will be there for the international break, a decent chance.
Well, Liverpool are playing Man City, yeah. So you need Spurs will need to win, and then Leicester's are at points. I think they're playing Leeds tonight, which obviously will have happened by the time you listen to this, but I think they're playing Wolves next weekend. So two quite tough games. It's not inconceivable they drop points. I think I'm right in saying this would be the latest that Spurs would have been top of the league in the Premier League ever.
Yeah, even in the title challenge seasons, they were never top, really, were they? They were always just behind Leicester in 15-16 and then Chelsea. Just a few issues from the game that I want to dig into. First one, a little bit more Gareth Bale. Mourinho hilariously said afterwards that he would be going on safari to read the reports in the Madrid press of Bale's performance. Now, that's funny because obviously managers who suggest they don't read the papers always, you know, I think that's always just a lie. Like, I think most managers do read what's written out there and they care about it much more than they let on.
Oh, you said Madrid websites. Right, yeah. I took that to mean the, like, official Madrid website.
I assumed he meant like marca.com.
He's not going to have to go on Safari to Google Real Madrid and then go to their website, is he? They used to have it on the shirt. He knows it's realmadrid.com.
Yeah, but I just wonder if someone who's still using Safari would be talking about the websites rather than papers.
You think he should just be loading it up on Encarta and then seeing what he can find out?
Maybe.
Surely he uses Safari on his iPhone, right? Because it's like the default browser on an iPhone.
I assume so, yeah. I assume that's what's happened.
Rather than on a laptop.
Some people use it on use Safari on laptops as well. I think it often is the default.
Not me. Chrome all the way. Jose, if you're listening, let us know which browser you use on which device to read marca.com. In terms of Gareth Bale's performance, guys, do you sense that he's getting closer? Like, he's obviously not arrived anywhere near 100%, but Charlie, do you sense that he's getting nearer to where Spurs need him to be?
Yeah, I think he is, but I think that is just playing games. Like, they have a fairly regimented sense. You know, they obviously know from his GPS kind of what his numbers are saying. And I think they have a pretty clear idea when they think he'll kind of have enough minutes in the legs. That, you know, he has had injuries. He's not played a huge amount of football since June, I think. And late June was his last game for Real Madrid. So, yeah, I think he is with each game. You know, he has to be carefully managed. But obviously it helps a lot when, you know, he shows that even at like 70, 80% fitness, he can still score goals like he did yesterday.
I mean, he basically did what Spurs have brought him in to do, right? To win games that otherwise they weren't going to win, which is exactly what he was doing in that last season, 2012-13. And you're right, Charlie. He wasn't massively involved in the game. You didn't really see much of him on a technical level that suggested he was a four-time Champions League winner and, you know, one of the highest paid players in the world or whatever else. But he did come good when Spurs needed to find another goal, and that's going to make a big difference, I think, to him in terms of his confidence. Because I do think that whatever you think about him and, you know, however he kind of holds himself, I definitely think he must have been feeling a little bit kind of battered by what had happened in Madrid and coming to England. And I don't know whether or not that kind of felt like a bit of a climb down for him to come back to Spurs. I think he probably needed a bit of a boost. And obviously what happened in the West Ham game, again, we're talking about it again. You know, you come on for your homecoming, your second debut, 3-0 up, and then your team comically managed to draw 3-3. Regardless or not whether you actually blame yourself for that, it is definitely going to be playing on your mind in the next few games you play, right?
Yeah, and Mourinho was quite interesting, actually. He talked about, after the game, he talked about how Bale had really helped, along with Kane, close out the game just by being... He said something about, you know, using their experience and professionalism. So I think he was talking about the way they kept the ball, kind of looked to win fouls in useful areas, and knew when to press and when not to press. So it may be, you know, at this stage, even when he's not fully fit, in more subtle ways, just by dint of his... you know, experience, you know, closing out so many tough big games, that could really help Tottenham, which obviously will be valuable given, as you say, James's first game saw that collapse from 3-0 up.
Well, that brings us on to the next thing I wanted to talk about, which is Harry Kane winning the penalty from Adam Lallana. I usually don't find refereeing talk at all interesting, but I do think this one is interesting because I think this is like a clever trick from Kane, I think it's fair to say, that we've seen a few times. So the way that he backs into Lallana, he obviously knows exactly where Lallana is and gets the foul, wins the penalty from VAR. We've seen him do similar against Cresswell, against West Ham, and against Fernandinho in the Champions League quarterfinal first leg in April 2019. This has been criticised quite a lot, we should say. Some people think that Kane is endangering opponents the way he does this. James, what's your take on it?
The first thing I'd say on the penalty is actually, I don't think the referee would have given that as a penalty if he'd realised it was in the penalty area. So he gave that foul as a free kick on the edge of the box. Yeah. And then VAR's basically grasped Lallana in and had given a penalty. I think if he'd known that had happened in the penalty area, if it had been 3 yards further into the penalty area and it had been obvious, I don't think he would have given a penalty for that. That feels like the kind of foul that's a free kick, not a penalty. Is that nonsense?
No, I think that's a really good point. And I also think with the VAR was slightly... I think the VAR was checking whether it was in the box rather than checking whether it was a foul the other way, which is what a lot of people think it was. So it was kind of a perfect storm that won Spurs that penalty.
And you're right to mention those challenges where Kane kind of nudges into a player who's jumping into the air. But the one, again, the Lallana one in the Brighton game was different to the Cresswell one and the Fernandinho one that you mentioned. And I've looked at both of them this morning, all three of them this morning. And, I mean, the Cresswell one was really bad. It basically rugby tackles Cresswell. Cresswell's just, like, standing three or four feet away from him, jumps straight up in the air for the ball. Kane isn't really competing for the ball. He just jumps into Cresswell quite low down. I mean, it is basically a rugby tackle. It's ludicrous. And you shouldn't be able to get away with things like that. That you shouldn't be doing things like that. I like the way that, you know, people can get knocked off balance when they're in the air. And I think we talked about this a couple of weeks ago. I think it might have been maybe Lucas in the Manchester United game. But I think, you know, you are really risking a player's possibility of getting injured in that kind of situation. And I think that is something he needs to curb and quickly, because... For obvious reasons, you know, there's a risk of injuring another player, but also now the kind of genie's out the bottle in terms of him doing this, it kind of feels like he's going to be at risk of being punished for it, which renders the whole thing completely pointless, obviously. But secondly, what I would say is that the one yesterday I think was quite different, because the ball is dropping between him and Lallana and he is moving towards the ball, and he does move his body around so he's facing goal. Now, I'm not suggesting he isn't trying to win a free kick there or to get fouled, because I think he is. But I don't think he's nudging Lallana out of his natural try, to be know what I mean, in an unfair way, like he did in those other two instances. Do you see what I mean? I think it's a slightly different thing. It's in the same ballpark, but I don't think it's quite as I don't think it's quite the same.
The fact that there's a precedent, or a couple of precedents, does make it seem as if this is something that Kane does all the time, which I think is probably an exaggeration. It's possible there's a slight conflation of the fact that Kane is very, very good at winning fouls. He does that brilliantly, has done for a few years, and often that's just done in quite a cute way. That's about where you position your body in relation to the ball. This is clearly different. You know, this is an extreme version of that, and it's different because it is actually dangerous. And you know, it's been spoken about that in rugby, if you do this kind of thing, if you impede someone, they're up in the air, it's an automatic red card. And obviously the reason is because the consequences are potentially quite severe. And look, I don't want to be getting on my high horse and saying, you know, someone could have been seriously hurt here, but there is a risk. And like James says, the genie's out of the bottle now, and it will be interesting to see, you know, how this is treated going forward and whether that makes a difference. And people are kind of wise to this.
You sometimes get this situation with players where once it's become like widely known that they have a clever little trick like this, that suddenly referees, like everyone becomes really conscious of it, both in the media and fans and players and eventually referees. Or I mean, some referees might well become conscious of it before the wider public does. I remember, I think it was Robin van Persie. Like Robin van Persie was like a really cynical elbower when the ball was in the air and he's challenging someone. And then he would never get punished for it. And then I can't remember who it was. I think it might even have been Neil Warnock or a man. I just have a really strong memory of going to covering an Arsenal game in about 20, like Van Persie's last season there. And somebody made a big fuss about it. And then suddenly Van Persie started getting called on this sort of stuff. So it's, I wonder like whether Kane will be able to win so many of these penalties in the future. I do think it is like not a great thing to be doing. Like it's kind of it's obviously effective in the sense of winning decisions.
He should have been sent off for the Creswell one. I mean, I'm looking at it again now, and I defy anyone listening to this to watch this clip and say he shouldn't have been sent off for that. It's ludicrously dangerous what he does. It's mad.
Yeah, someone could easily like break an arm or like pop your shoulder out or something.
Yeah,
hitting
exactly
the ground like that on the way down. And it was interesting that in that City Champions League game that Fernandinho, who, you know, let's be honest, is absolutely no stranger to dark arts himself and knows every trick in the book, he was so aggrieved by Kane doing this that he elbowed Kane in the back of the head and then like pushed his face into the grass after their incident. And then like literally one or 2 minutes later, I think, Kane tries to go through Fabian Delph on the touchline and ends up injuring his own ankle. So, and yeah, this is absolutely not me taking a side of Fernandinho's side against Kane on this, because Fernandinho is as canny as they come. But it is something to be aware of, I think, with Kane. But it's effective.
It's interesting as well, though, isn't it? Because I think in the kind of VAR ideologues' minds, you know, when VAR was being talked about, the dream was that they would spot these kinds of dangerous off the ball. Like that Creswell incident, I think, is a really hard thing to spot in real time. But I guess the dream with VAR was that it would be this all-seeing eye that would spot these dark arts that previously weren't seen and come down on them. But that isn't really how it seems to be used. It's more kind of for existing decisions that have been made, forensically analysing them.
Completely, yeah. Because ultimately, with this sort of thing, like, there is a lot of subjectivity in it. Like, one person's this is a bad foul by Harry Kane could be another, like, Kane was fouled, or it's a collision, or there just is no... I don't think there is, like, an objective truth when it comes to judging these kind of situations, which, again, like, as you say, Charlie, like, undermines the futility of VAR in the sense that you're expecting that replays alone will allow us to reach some kind of objective truth in decision-making when that objective truth is inaccessible. It doesn't exist.
This episode is supported by FX's Welcome to Wrexham. Celebrity owners Rob McElhenney and Ryan Reynolds' small-town Welsh football club has finally been promoted into League Two after 15 seasons in the National League. Dedicated staff and supporters celebrate the city's return to glory while bracing for the newfound challenges that come with being in a higher league. Will Wrexham AFC stand up to the challenge and rise again into League One? FX's Welcome to Wrexham premieres May 2nd on FX. Stream on Hulu.
Højbjerg, Charlie, you wrote about Pierre-Emile Højbjerg in your piece. Looks like he had another fantastic game. and is just making a great impression at Tottenham at the moment.
Yeah, I've been speaking to a few people about you know, how Højbjerg's been settling in, and all the noises from, you know, people at the club and from people kind of in and around the club is just really positive. You know, I did a big profile on him when he signed for Spurs, and, you know, born leader was a term I heard a lot. You know, and as well as that, people talking about his intensity, his seriousness, his leadership skills, and all of those things are playing out at Tottenham, it seems. You know, he's someone who I think some of his teammates maybe were a little bit surprised at the start just by how kind of seriously he does take things. You know, he very much is there at training and at games to work, you know, work as hard as he can. He does have a lighthearted side as well, but yeah, he's a really serious customer. And I enjoyed yesterday, I was keeping quite a close eye and ear on him. And he is very, very vocal, you know, really dishing instructions out to his teammates. At one point, you know, to Kane as well, he was telling him to get back when Brighton were taking a goal kick, you know, so not one to stand on ceremony, you know, even if it's with, you know, Tottenham's talisman and all the rest of it. So yeah, I just thought that was really impressive. And he, you know, he's played really well for them as well. You know, he's not just a destroyer, he's someone who sees himself, or for most of his career saw himself as a number eight, or if he was going to play that more six role, was there to kind of make stuff happen. And it's funny, it's only later on in his career that he's added the interceptions, the tackling and that sort of thing, which is what I think most people know him for. You know, he is a more complete midfielder than that. And, you know, he's shown this already with that lovely assist for Serge Aurier's goal at Old Trafford. And then yesterday he was involved in the move that Spurs won the penalty from, with a really nice probing penetrative forward pass to Lamella that then led to Son getting his cross away and Spurs getting that pen. So another really good performance. And I was struck, actually, he hasn't missed a minute in the Premier League this season for Mourinho, Spurs. Only him and Lloris can say that, no other outfielder, which tells you how valuable he is. And I know when he went down with that injury, there was that collective intake of breath from Spurs fans of like, please, please, no, not Højbjerg. Like, we really, really can't do without him. So just a really impressive start to his Spurs career, especially so because that Everton game on his debut, he was a bit sluggish. He looked a little off the pace. And I think a lot of people were thinking like, oh, you know, is this, have we signed a dud here? Is this the signing we should have been making? And he's really, really been impressive since. So yeah, I mean, again, like we keep saying, you know, there is this caveat of let's see how he does in those big games. But given his temperament, I think he'll be really relishing those matches against, you know, the supposed big teams. And yeah, really looking forward to testing himself. So yeah, very impressive from him. And obviously, like, the in theory, the black mark against him from yesterday was the fact that he gave the ball away in the build-up to the Brighton equaliser. But I think 99% of people watching that replay thought that was a foul. You know, it certainly looked like a foul. So I don't think we can criticise him too much for that. But yeah, very, very impressive again. And just someone, I think, and James, you can tell me on this, but it does seem like someone who fans really like, because he is so committed and so wholehearted and, you know, gets his foot in, and because he solves an obvious problem that Spurs have had for a while, which is the lack of that DM with real bite to him. So yeah, looking like a really good signing so far.
Yeah, it's a bit of an odd one. You know, I feel like he definitely would be a cult hero by now, but obviously without fans in the ground, it's kind of... it's kind of hard for that kind of rapport to be built up, isn't it? I mean, on social media, there's loads of it. And he was a player who was getting the most love on Twitter after the game yesterday. Yeah, I mean, I think he's made such a big difference. And you're right, Charlie, it's not just kind of what he does on a technical level and the aggression that he brings in, the organisation that he brings, but it's also kind of that the mentality that he has that I think makes quite a big difference. And as we said at the start of the season, or as we kind of expected might happen, he has, I think, given, particularly in Ndombele, like a bit more of a platform to thrive in a way that he just couldn't do last season. And, you know, yesterday against Brighton wasn't Ndombele's best game of the season by any stretch. But I think you could see that having someone like Højbjerg there, he's a bit more disciplined, although obviously, you know, he isn't just a player who just sit there and not leave the centre circle. You know, he will go off and try and create a little bit as well. And he definitely can pass the ball. We saw that against Manchester United. I just think he's one of those players that has improved the team and will improve the players within the team. You're right. Against Everton, he was pretty dreadful, really. One of the worst players on the pitch in, you know, a performance from Spurs that was more or less dreadful to a man. and he was up against Alan for Everton, who was incredible in that game. And you thought, well, yeah, there's an obvious comparison there, that the guy Everton have ended up signing because they couldn't get Højbjerg is actually much better. But since then, he has been absolutely incredible. Yeah, and the only worry, obviously, is that they may become almost too reliant on him, and then what they'll do when they need to rotate him out, or if he gets injured or suspended or whatever. But I suppose that's just a bridge that Spurs will have to cross when they get there.
Yeah, I think he's been fantastic for Spurs. It's kind of satisfying to see someone who brings all of the traits that Spurs were hoping he would bring, both like on a technical level, because as Charlie says, they haven't had a good holding midfielder since Wanyama, and also in a personality sense as well, because he has that kind of vocal leadership style that frankly Spurs haven't had an awful lot of in the last 5 or 10 years, really. I remember when I, back in July, I think it was July or August, when I interviewed Eric Dyer, we were chatting about Højbjerg and Hart, who just joined the club. And Dyer said, there's definitely a certain type of character in those two that Mourinho is looking for. They're quite similar in terms of their attitude and character, and I think that's important. To avoid those kind of results, like the one at Sheffield United, because we've been talking about the game they lost there back in June, it's important to have that kind of person. So I do think he has, like, it looks to me like he has changed the energy of the team in quite a significant way. And I think it's no surprise that he's played, what was it, almost every minute. I think he started 10 out of the Spurs' 13 games so far this season.
He's played every Premier League minute.
Yeah, it's fantastic. And if he stays fit, and he kind of, you know, famous last words, he looks like the kind of player who wouldn't really get injured that much. Like, it's not like he's sprinting around all the time, twanging his hamstrings. So I imagine he'll be the kind of player who, by the end of the season, will have played hundreds and hundreds of minutes for Spurs, or rather thousands and thousands, like more than anyone else.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
One other thing I want to talk about on today's show. Today is the 10th anniversary of the 3-1 win against Inter. And Charlie, you've written a really, really interesting piece looking back at that Champions League campaign, talking to all sorts of people. What was your favourite bit in there? Because there's a lot of stuff in there that I think Spurs fans will really enjoy reading.
Yeah, I mean, it was so fun talking to Redknapp and Van der Vaart and people like Les Ferdinand and the coaching staff and fans and media and commentators, like, you know, a real Pavlichenko we have from as well. I think there's a lot in there for Tottenham fans. And it is just, you know, the fondness of the feeling of doing something for the first time. Like, that, to me, that run is like the prototype for why football is really fun as a fan. When you're doing something you've never done, you're going to cool, exciting places, you're beating some of the best teams in the world, and you're doing it playing this really exciting brand of football. It just felt really magical then, and it still does now, and has so many moments that have gone down in folklore. I mean, yeah, today's the 10th anniversary from the 3-1 home win, the Taxi for Maicon game. Obviously, you had Bale's hat-trick at San Siro, Crouch's winner at San Siro against Milan in the last 16, and Gattuso and Joe Jordan squaring up. You know, even the Twente win, which was Tottenham's first Champions League home game proper at White Hart Lane since 1962. I mean, that's how long it had been since they'd played in what was then the European Cup. And that 4-1 Twente win was just this kind of helter-skelter ride in the pouring rain, and Van der Vaart scored this great goal. He got sent off. Bale scored a really nice goal. Spurs scored two penalties. Van der Vaart missed a penalty. Like, they were so exciting, that team. And I made the point at the beginning, like, this is what a European Super League is trying to stop. And all of football is geared towards stopping this. You know, a team from outside the established order coming in and blooding the noses of football royalty. I mean, this was at an age where the top four was so entrenched. It was always the same four teams. And not since 2002, 2003 season had a team other than those four been in the group stage of the Champions League. Everton did finish fourth in 2004-05, but they lost their qualifier. And it was the first time since 2001-02, when Liverpool did it, that an English team made, a Premier League team made their debut in the Champions League. So for lots of reasons, it just felt really new and different and exciting. You know, 10 years on, people talk about it with such fondness. I think it was the highlight for a lot of, a lot of the people I spoke to, and including some supporters. Kat Law, who we've had on this podcast, she said to me, you know, she actually, in a lot of respects, looks back on this campaign more fondly even than the one where they reached the final. Partly just because it was new and different and...
It was more fun.
Yeah, and more fun. But I mean, James, I'd be really interested to hear your kind of view on this as, you know, as someone I imagine who experienced it firsthand at the time.
Yeah, I mean, Kat's experience would have been different because she would have been to the away games and I only went to the home games in that year. But yeah, I would agree with that. I mean, it was like a complete it was like a free hit, basically, the whole thing. And what people looking at that group now might not realise is that actually it was a really hard group. Spurs were in the third pot. Inter would obviously had won it the previous year and were top seeds in the whole thing. Bremen somehow were the top seeds in the second pot. And I think Twente were top seeds in the fourth pot. It was like the hardest possible draw in terms of like UEFA coefficient they could have had. And they, you know, win the group and smash the European champions. And we've talked about this a couple of times on the podcast before, but that home game against Inter at proper White Hart Lane was the best game that I've ever been to. It was absolutely incredible. It was like completely breathless, and it was the Premier League like impacting itself onto the Champions League. It was incredibly red up. It's the only way he could do that. It wasn't like being kind of clever tactically without kind of trying to play him down, which I'm not, but it wasn't like, you know, he made any kind of concessions to playing against Inter Milan. He got his team to play the way his team played and to do that really well. And they absolutely wiped the floor with him.
They exposed Inter, you know, this team who was seen as untouchable, and they just made them look really slow and old. And then against Milan in that away game at San Siro and the home game to a degree, they were a lot more disciplined and they played in a slightly different way. So I think credit to Redknapp. It wasn't just a kind of up and at them kind of philosophy. They did also have some discipline and some tactical nous as well, which... You know, just to have that, so to have that feather in the cap, that away win at Inter, that away win at Milan, the 1-0, as well as just blitzing Inter in that 3-1 game, is incredible. And like James says, you know, people I spoke to for PC say it is the best game they've ever been at, the best atmosphere, just absolutely electric. So just a joy to relive it, really.
You're right to mention that Milan game, the last 16 game where they went and won 1-0. And they had so many players missing in that game. Let me read you the team from that game, because it is ludicrous. And if you look at the team photo from this game, it is mad. And this is with full respect to all these players. So the starting 11, and frustratingly, I'm looking at this on the BBC website and I've not put them in position order, so I'm very quickly reorganising them in my brain now. Right, Gomez in goal, Chorluka, Dawson, Gallas, Asuakoto, Lennon, Palacios, Sandro... Stephen Pienaar, Van der Vaart, Peter Crouch. Modric wasn't fit and he came on for Van der Vaart, so they both went on the pitch at the same time. So you didn't have Bale, Modric and Van der Vaart weren't fairly fit. Who else was missing? Nedley King was missing. Whoever else.
People like Huddleston. I mean, also, if you think that Milan team, you know, that was Ibra, Robinho, Pato.
Yeah, Gattuso still, as you say. Thiago Silva, when he was like, maybe the best centre-back in the world, perhaps.
Yeah, that was some win. And then the home game, I mean, from people I spoke to, James, I don't know if you remember, just that it was unbearably tense having to defend that lead and it being 0-0.
My memory of that game is that there weren't really any chances.
Mm.
Was there some weird thing with William Gallas?
Gallas cleared one off the line.
That's right, yeah. It was quite a weird chance though, wasn't it? It wasn't like...
Yeah, but the thing is, like, in that, when a game's on such a knife edge... things that don't feel like a big chance on TV, like a low skimmer from 20 yards, when you're at the ground, that is the most terrifying thing, especially if your sight line is like you're behind the opposite goal or something, and it, you know, everything looks like the opposition are about to score. And there were a few of those in that game, you know, just those kind of half chances, snapshots, things like that. Rubinho has a few decent efforts, which, yeah, at the time, if you're at the game and just biting your fingernails, that they feel a lot more terrifying than they might if you're just watching on TV, say.
I think one of the things that really comes through in your piece, Charlie, that is so interesting to me is how in the last few years, Spurs have basically made themselves into a much bigger club than they were 10 years ago. And it's easy to forget how thrilling and new this felt at the time for Spurs fans, like, because it did feel like they were really crashing the party in a way that, say, like the 2018-19 run, which was in some ways better, but it, like, less surprising given how well Spurs had played under Pochettino for the last 3 or 4 years. Whereas this, it was just kind of wild seeing this team who'd been kind of bouncing around the Europa League positions in the Premier League for the pre, or what were then the UEFA Cup positions, in the for most of the 2000s under Yol and various other managers, suddenly like destroying the team who'd literally just won the treble.
Totally. And if you think even the previous season, Bale was still second choice left back for a lot of it. It was only kind of the second half of the season that he came to the fore and really helped them qualify for the Champions League. But he only scored a couple of league goals that season. I think it was three. He scored three league goals that season. You know, so his acceleration was absurd, and as was the team's. Yeah, it wasn't like, you know, the sort of natural next step that everyone foresaw for this team. You know, this team who'd been, yeah, like you say, bobbing around the Europa League positions, going, you know, a few years before that mid-table, that they would be handing out a spanking to the European champions. It was just like, wow. And also, I think what was so important about this run was the way it did change perceptions of Tottenham, and it made them into a team that was like, yeah, we absolutely should be playing in the Champions League. This is where we belong. Anything other than that is a failure. And it, yeah, it took a few years before they did become regulars, but they then did. And now anything other than Champions League is a complete failure. And this really was the first step towards that, I think.
Yeah, and I'd be interested to like learn more about how much it changed, for example, like the level of player they could get. I mean, they didn't actually sign that many good players around, unless I'm being incredibly unfair to anyone. I suppose in 2012 they got Lloris and Vertonghen, who have both been brilliant signings for Spurs. And it might well be that if you're Lloris and Vertonghen and you're playing for Lyon and Ajax and you're like very, very obviously going to be a big player over the next 10 years, and frankly, players like that have got their pick of European clubs to go to, I wonder whether the fact that Spurs had had this incredibly eye-catching Champions League run would have made them more likely to join the club and go and play for Harry Redknapp Spurs in a way which before this they just wouldn't have considered it.
Yeah, quite possibly. I think it did change how they were perceived. And you know, obviously then they pointed AVB to replace Redknapp, and they were certainly wanting to move towards being more of a kind of serious continental outfit.
Excellent. Well, that's all we've got time for on this week's podcast. But if you want to read Charlie's excellent piece, obviously it's on theathletic.com, or you can find it via our Twitter. We'll be back again same time next week, where we will be looking back on Spurs' trip to Ludogorets, which is this Thursday, and then their Premier League game against West Brom, which is this Sunday. And it could be the game when Spurs go top. As always, if you've got anything you want us to talk about on the show, please just tweet us or leave a comment. But we'll be back again next week.